The H-bomb was not the only issue on which Oppenheimer found himself bucking the Cold War armaments buildup. By 1949, he had despaired of making progress in the foreseeable future on nuclear disarmament. He still believed Bohr's vision of global openness was mankind's only hope in the nuclear age. But developments in the early Cold War had made it clear that the negotiations in the United Nations to control nuclear weapons were at an impasse. Instead, Oppenheimer tried to use his influence to put a damper on the government's and the public's growing expectations for all things nuclear. That summer, the press quoted him as saying that nuclear power for planes and battleships is so much hogwash. Inside the General Advisory Committee, GAC, Oppenheimer and the other scientists criticized the Air Force's Project Lexington, a program to develop nuclear-powered bomber aircraft. He also talked about the potential dangers inherent in civilian nuclear power plants. Such statements did not endear him to those in the defense establishment or the power industry who favored the development of nuclear-based technologies. Indeed, the GAC's experiences with the military brass left all of its members increasingly uneasy about the military's nuclear weapons planning. "I know," recalled Lee Dubridge, "that there was a great deal of discussion about targets in the Soviet Union and how many bombs it would take to knock out the major industrial centers. At the time, we thought 50 would just about wipe out the essential things in the Soviet Union." Dubridge always thought that was a pretty good estimate, but over time, the Pentagon's representatives kept finding pretexts to push the number higher. Dubridge recalled, "We used to sometimes smile about this, that they always could seem to find targets for whatever number of bombs they thought they could get in the next year or two. They adjusted their target goals to the production goals." Oppenheimer's presentations at GAC meetings were normally impeccably objective. Rarely did he reveal any emotion. One exception occurred when Vice Admiral Hyman Rickover briefed the committee on the Navy's rush to develop nuclear-powered submarines. Rickover complained that the AEC was not working hard enough on reactor development. He challenged Oppenheimer by asking if he had waited until he had all the facts before building an atomic bomb. Oppenheimer gave him one of his ice-cold, blue-eyed stares and said yes. Though the admiral was notoriously overbearing, Oppenheimer restrained himself until Rickover departed. Oppie then walked over to a table where Rickover had left a small wooden model submarine. Placing his hand around the hull, he quietly crushed it and then silently walked away. Oppenheimer was expanding his circle of political enemies. As his old friend Harold Chernus had observed years earlier, Oppie's remarks could be very cruel. He was often kind and considerate to subordinates, but he could be very cutting to colleagues. Louis Strauss remained Oppenheimer's most dangerous political enemy. He had not forgotten how Oppenheimer had ridiculed his recommendations at a congressional hearing the previous summer. "These are not happy days for me," Strauss wrote a friend in July 1949. Having repeatedly dissented inside the AEC over various policies, Strauss felt on the defensive. With Oppenheimer and his friends in mind, he complained privately that "I have been guilty in their eyes of Lee's majesty in having the effrontery to disagree with my colleagues." He believed that Oppenheimer's close friends Herbert Marx and Ann Wilson Marx were spreading stories to the effect that "I am an isolationist." When a friend observed that some people seemed to think it effrontery for anyone to differ with Dr. Oppenheimer on a scientific matter, Strauss wrote a memo for his files on the theme of omniscience, in which he noted that Oppenheimer had once proposed denaturing uranium, a process that had since been proven impossible. Strauss also convinced himself that Oppenheimer was consciously trying to slow work on the thermonuclear bomb. He thought of Oppenheimer as a general who did not want to fight. Victory could hardly be expected. Early in 1951, Strauss, though no longer an AEC commissioner, went to AEC Chairman Gordon Dean and, reading from a carefully drafted memo, accused Oppenheimer of sabotaging the project. He said, "Something radical must be done," strongly implying that Oppenheimer should be fired. And, as if to underscore the political risks of taking on the scientist, Strauss ended the meeting by melodramatically throwing the memo into the fire in Dean's fireplace. Consciously or not, it was a metaphorical gesture. The security of the country demanded that Oppenheimer's influence be reduced to ashes. Back in the autumn of 1949, just as the internal debate over the super was heating up, Strauss was apprised of top-secret information that further fueled his suspicions of Oppenheimer. In mid-October, the FBI informed him that decrypted Soviet cable traffic indicated that a Soviet spy had been operating out of Los Alamos. The crypts seemed to implicate a British physicist, Klaus Fuchs, who had arrived at Los Alamos in 1944 as a member of the British scientific mission. In the weeks ahead, it would become clear to Strauss and others that Fuchs had had ample access to classified information about both the atomic bomb and the super. While the FBI and the British investigated Fuchs, Strauss began his own investigation of Oppenheimer. He phoned General Groves and, referring to information in Oppenheimer's FBI file, asked about the Chevalier affair. In response, Groves wrote Strauss two long letters trying to explain what had happened in 1943 and why he had accepted Oppenheimer's explanation of Chevalier's activities. In his first letter, he was emphatic in his belief that Oppenheimer was a loyal American. In his second, he tried to convey the complexity of the Chevalier affair. Groves also made it clear that he did not think that Robert's behavior in the incident was incriminating. "It is important to realize," he wrote Strauss, "that if we had eliminated promptly every man who had in the past had associations with friends who were communistically inclined, or who had been sympathetic to the Russians at one time or another, that we would have lost many of our most able scientists." Finding Groves' defense of Oppenheimer unsatisfactory, Strauss continued his search for incriminating information. By early December, he was in communication with Groves' former aide, Colonel Kenneth Nichols, who loathed Oppenheimer. Over the next several years, Nichols would become one of Strauss' assistants and confidants. The two men bonded in their hostility to Oppenheimer. Now Nichols gladly provided Strauss with a copy of Arthur Compton's September 1945 letter to Henry Wallace, in which Compton, allegedly speaking also for Oppenheimer, Lawrence, and Fermi, had stated they would prefer defeat in war over a victory won by use of a genocidal weapon like the superbomb. This view outraged Strauss, who saw in Compton's letter further evidence of Oppenheimer's dangerous influence. That Compton had written the letter and had noted that Lawrence and Fermi supported his argument made no difference to Strauss.